Next prayer meeting for the whole English congregation is on the 15th. Slight change because, you know, how the calendar works. And plus, Han's away. And college career meeting is this Wednesday. And I didn't put Wednesday on it, huh? This is what happens when the person who's also in charge of the bulletin is also away. And so I had to do the bulletin too. So I missed stuff. But Wednesday, second floor, 7 o'clock. We're continuing on Bible study, and we'll have dinner served. All right. I think that's all the announcements. So let's open up our Bibles. And we are in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 7. If you're using the church Bible, what page is it? 631. All right, 631. Okay, you remember that we're in Daniel because we want to see from the examples in the book of Daniel what it means for someone to live out a life of faith and yet not be surrounded by a community of believers. Not that he didn't have anyone else. He had his three friends. But Daniel is living out most of his life of faith as part of God's people, not in Israel, but in Babylon. And then, well, actually, last chapter in Syria, in Persia, in Medo-Persia. And when we were looking at Leviticus, you know, even though there were so many rules and regulations and how to follow God, it was kind of easier because you were surrounded by people doing the same thing. It was easy to keep kosher. It was easier to pray when everyone's praying at those times. So easy. But yet Daniel was in a foreign land trying to live out his faith. And the illustration we've been using is salt. Jesus has called us to be salt. And yet Daniel and we are called to spend most of our time not in the salt shaker. Right now we're in a salt shaker. We're surrounded by salt. We've got, you know, Christian believers left and right, and you know, it's easier to pray, it's easier to have Bible study when everyone's doing it, it's easier to worship when we're all worshiping together, but then we leave, we go outside the salt shaker, we go to school, we go to work, we go back home maybe, and then we're all alone, we're outside the salt shaker. How do we stay salty? How do we live out our Christian lives? So that's where we're in Daniel. Daniel chapter 7 marks a big change in the book of Daniel. If you've ever read through the book of Daniel before, you know half of the book of Daniel is narrative and half of it is dreams and visions. And so we've got through the narrative part, which was, you know, the fun part. Well, I mean, the visions are fun, but in a different way. The narratives are the part that, you know, they always go and talk about Sunday school. Yeah, you know, you always have the, you know, when you're in the children's Sunday school, you always get the stories of Daniel the lion's den. You know, sometimes you'll get the stories of, you know, Daniel and not eating the food from the king's table, or the you know, the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, or the fiery furnace. But then when you start to get to Daniel chapter 6, that's when, you know, most of the children's Sunday school curriculum just kind of skips over, right? And like, it doesn't cover Daniel chapter 7 through the end. And so we're kind of starting in more unfamiliar territory here. So before we read it, of course, we should mention that it is a dream, it's a vision that Daniel has. And so therefore, kind of how we interpret it is going to be different than how we interpreted the narrative part, you know, the story part. You know, the story part, we can see Daniel's example, we can see how he lived out his faith, but then the visions are something entirely different. Dreams are more visceral. Like, have you ever just had such a vivid dream that you just wake up and like you felt that it was real, and like, you know, just the colors or the feelings that you had in the dream were just so vivid. And so as we go through the visions, the pictures are really going to pop out at us. And some of those things are going to have, actually a lot of them are going to have historical references. You know, they apply to things that have already happened. Some of the things will apply to some things that will happen in the future. Some of these things will be metaphorical, and some things we have no idea what they're talking about. So it's just the nature of visions. So let's start reading. We'll read the first, say, 8 verses or so, and then we'll get into it. Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven, churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them. 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully." All right, let's just pause there for a drink of water. Daniel has this terrifying dream, and it reflects what has happened in Daniel so far. In fact, that should sound familiar because it's very much like Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel chapter 2. Right? Nebuchadnezzar, if you remember, he dreamt about a statue, and there are 4 parts to it representing 4 different kingdoms. The Babylonian kingdom empire, the Medo-Persian kingdom, the Greek kingdom, the Roman kingdom, empire, and then the statue was destroyed by a rock, right? You remember that? Sounds familiar. So here we have, instead of it envisioned as 4 different parts of a statue, it's beasts. And it's a terrifying vision. These 4 beasts are coming out of the sea. You might wonder, why does it come out of the sea? It does kind of sound like those Godzilla movies that have come out. You know, all the monsters, they come out of the sea. They don't come from space. They don't come from a mountain. They come out of the sea. Why is that? Because the sea, for most of humanity, it's actually right now, it's kind of unknown. It's kind of scary. And we see that even the fishermen in the New Testament, when they went out on the Sea of Galilee, they were, you know, it wasn't comfortable. They knew that at any moment, a storm could come through and they'd all be killed. So the sea, even though it gave them livelihood, it gave them fish, it was terrifying. And so it represents a place of chaos and turmoil. And that is the origin of these beasts. These kingdoms that rise up come out of chaos, turmoil. And these represent the kingdoms of man. So first, the first beast in, verse 4, looks like a lion with wings like an eagle. And then he gets turned into a man. And then the second beast, verse 5, is like a bear with already part of his last meal stuck in his mouth. He's got like ribs hanging out of his mouth. And then verse 6, like a leopard with four wings on its back. And then the seventh beast, he can't even describe it. It doesn't even get described as a beast. He just says it's terrifying, it's frightening, and it's powerful. It's got iron teeth and devours its victim and tramples them underfoot. Can't even describe it as an animal that we know of. And this terrifying vision represents the nations of the world that have come up. Specifically, you know, the four: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and the Roman Empire, as we saw in chapter 2. But Daniel is here kind of giving us a vision of comfort, where God is giving Daniel the comforting vision, and then Daniel's relaying it to us. These beasts are terrifying. These are the kingdoms of men come out of chaos. They're chaotic, they're turbulent. They seem to, you know, they don't fear God. They seem to be at odds with God and his people. And despite being scary, God wants to give Daniel some hope, some comfort. Right, this is what Daniel's been living through. He's been living through Babylon, conquering Jerusalem, destroying the temple, taking people away. He's going to experience soon the Medo-Persians coming in and conquering the Babylonians. And God says there's going to be two more kingdoms after that. There's even going to be more terrifying. But hey, comfort Daniel. And we get a little bit of comfort in this beginning chapter. There's little hints of it. You look at the verb tense. And I know most of us, well, probably all of us, you know, grammar is not our friend. If they even teach grammar anymore. I don't think I was taught grammar until I like started taking Spanish, and then like, what's all this grammar? What's going on? I don't understand. Grammar is not usually our friend because, you know, it's usually hard to understand, and unless you're one of those people that are really up on grammar and you want to make sure that everything's punctuated properly. Maybe you're that kind of person. But if you look at the verbs in this passage, you'll notice something interesting. Or at least most of the verbs that relate to the beasts are all in the passive tense. You know, the verbs can be active, I go to the store. Or it could be passive, you drove me to the store. Right? Active is, I do this. Passive is, something is done to me. And so even though these beasts representing the kingdoms of this world are terrifying, and it seems like they have all authority and all the power, yet Daniel's giving us a glimpse, just with the verb tenses, right? The first beast, what happens to it? His wings are torn off. He's given the mind of a man. Does he have authority? No, he doesn't. As terrifying as he is, it seems like there's someone else in charge that's doing stuff to him. The second beast, the bear. It was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh. Does it have complete and utter authority? No, it doesn't. It's being commanded around. It's being told to do something, and it does it. The third beast, like a leopard with wings, was given authority. seems powerful, seems authoritative, but it does not have ultimate authority. Its authority is given to it by someone else. There's someone else behind the scenes operating all the mechanisms. And that's where the comfort is. If you were here super early, beginning of the service, I made a reference to The Wizard of Oz. And The Wizard of Oz, you know, the main character, Dorothy, gets transported to magical land and blah, 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 and tries to get back. And the only way she can get back is by finding the Wizard of Oz. And she meets the Wizard of Oz in Emerald City, and it's just terrifying, and it's grand, and it's huge, and it's amazing, and you know, tells Dorothy to do some other stuff so that he'll send her back. She does the other stuff, comes back, and then her dog senses something behind a curtain and reveals that all this big, splendorous thing that they thought was the Wizard of Oz was just a middle-aged man behind a curtain pulling lots of levers. It was all like smoke, is all, you know, a big show. And so the vision that we're given here is for the purpose of taking back that curtain. That's why I called the sermon this morning Behind the Curtain. And God wants to give Daniel and us a look behind the curtain. What's happening may sound and look terrifying. Our nation might be unstable. The world might be unstable. There might be lots of stress out there. Everything might seem to be, as in the first part of Daniel chapter 7, coming out of chaos. And it may feel like your world is getting swept up in turbulence. And you're being attacked by beasts. Daniel's vision is to take the curtain away and show who's really in charge. Who's this person that has ultimate authority? The one to whom all the nations of the world owe their power to and must answer to. So let's take down the curtain and let's continue reading at verse 9. All right, different scene change. It's like watching a movie. As I looked, thrones were set up in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing out before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and his body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. All right, let's look behind the curtain. What's happening? Daniel is taken up in his vision and given a heavenly perspective. And we notice something about this heavenly scene. It's completely different from the earthly scene. The earthly scene is turbulence, chaos, beasts coming out of the ocean, terrifying and horrible, destroying and eating and devouring. And then you go into heaven and it's calm and it's ordered. God is on the throne. Now I'm going to make an anime reference, and for some of you, it will make me sound very old. And for others, it will make me sound very young. I'll just have to live with that. In the 90s, I think. But don't worry, there was an anime that came out. Well, it was very influential. It's still around. You can, you know, it's very popular in Japan still, called Evangelion. You know, from Gainax, and very popular anime. But one of the kind of the main players in the movie, this organization called NERVE, they have a slogan on their little logo thing. Does anyone remember what that slogan is? Yeah. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. Now, what they meant in saying that is God's all the way up there, so we're okay down here. Like, it's we're good as long as he stays away. Right? That's what that means. That would not be comforting if that was what Daniel was saying, or what Daniel's vision was saying. It's not. It's, in fact, exactly the opposite. God is on his throne, and that means he's got authority, and he's in charge. That the one who rules over everything is at his seat of power. You notice he's not running around. He's not standing around nervously. He's not pacing. He's not twiddling his thumbs. He's seated. Everything is going according to plan. He's not stressed out. He is seated and reigning. That when God is on his throne, that means for us, everything is going according to his plan. And though we might be in a boat or we might feel like we're drowning in an ocean of stress, even though it might feel like we're being attacked from all sides, we know that God is in control. And that's what that vision means. When God is seated on his throne, that means he's not missing. He's in charge. So that's the first comforting thing we see. And it describes God as giving him a title. It doesn't actually call him God at all. I just kind of gave away some spoilers here. But it calls him the Ancient of Days. Gives a title for God instead of giving us, you know, God sat on his throne. Because he's trying to emphasize a characteristic of who God is. Remember, it's a vision. And so we get impressions, we get pictures. God as the Ancient of Days. That God has been around forever. He's pre-existed all the turbulence that we're feeling. He's pre-existed all the nations that came around. Everything that has happened, he's been there before it all happened, before it all started. He's always on the scene, and he's always in charge. He says he's, lost my place here, his clothing is white as snow. Of course, I personally like that verse very much, because I do wear a lot of white. But his clothes are white, signifying his pureness, his holiness, that he has accomplished all his plans without cutting corners, or getting his hands dirty, or doing anything wrong. He has always done right. He is always pure and holy. The hair of his head is white as wool. You know, on Wednesday we talked about maybe he has very soft curly hair that's white. But it's probably talking about the color, that it's white. That he is wise, ultimate wisdom is his. That everything going on is according to a perfect, wise plan. And there's flaming fire coming out from his throne, and it's got wheels that are on fire too. Everything's on fire. You know, he's holy. He's terrifying. But fire also has that significance of judgment. This holy God is standing in judgment on what is happening in the world. Its wheels are especially probably important for Daniel because, you know, wheels signify mobility. You got wheels, you can travel. And so God, his throne, has wheels. That means he's not just God in Jerusalem. He's not just God in Judea. He's also God in Babylon. He's also God in Persia. He's God in Greece. He's God in Rome. He's God in the United States. He's God everywhere. Everywhere he rules. He's God in China. He's God in Haiti. He's God everywhere. And Daniel sees thousands upon thousands attending him, and I'm sure that would also be a comfort, Daniel. And it's a comfort for us when we're, you know, that salt outside of the salt shaker, when it seems we're all alone, when it seems like we're the only salty one, when it seems like everyone else is against us. Daniel gets this picture of heaven, and he sees God is not just singularly being worshipped just by Daniel himself. God is being worshipped by tens and hundreds and thousands upon thousands of thousands. So it continues, the courts are seated and the books are open in judgment. They're finally going to tackle the beast problem, the beast infestation on the earth. And then what follows is the most anticlimactic battle between good and evil that has ever been written down. Right? When we think about battles between good and evil, we think Hollywood, we think, you know, the world's in the balance. Who's going to win, good or evil? We don't know. And then they battle it out, and they have this climactic, big, humongous battle, and then good side wins, yay! And then evil's defeated, and everything's right. But here, what happens? God's seated on a throne. He says, okay, open up the books. Let's start the trial. Evil, you're guilty. You're punished. The end. Like, that's why no one makes a movie out of this. But this is what the struggle against good and evil really looks like in the spiritual realms. Right? Again, we're taking back the curtain, and we're taking a look at what really happens. This is a spiritual vision of what's going on in the world. Luther wrote the hymn, right, that kind of mirrors what Daniel is seeing in his vision. Though the wrong seems off so strong, God is the ruler yet. And so when good and evil clash, there's no fight. There's no contest because God always wins. And so that's what we see. God is on his throne. Evil gets punished. That's it. End of story. Verse 13. Let's see kind of another glimpse behind the scenes. What's happening? In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion was an everlasting dominion, and that a dominion that will never pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. We see here the completion of the vision from Daniel chapter 2. After the four nations come up, there's a stone that comes and knocks down all the nations, and that stone gets built up into a nation itself, not formed by human hands, that lives forever. Of course, we know who the Son of Man is. This is obviously a messianic title. But yet, if you look at the words, all it says is Son of Man just means human. Right? For those of you reading through Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's the same as saying Son of Adam or Daughter of Eve. It just means person. But yet, as you look at this description, it obviously has to be more than just a human being. Because God himself, the Ancient of Days, gives this Son of Man authority and dominion and a kingdom that lasts forever. Now, if you've read your Bible, you know God does not give glory to another. God is God, and he deserves all the glory because he is God. So who is this one who is receiving glory from God? It must be also God. This Son of Man must be divine, or God would not, the Ancient of Days would not give him this authority, this power, this glory. So that is part of the reason why Jesus uses this title the most. Out of every title for the Messiah, he uses this title the most. So he always says, talking about himself, you will see the Son of Man. And he gets it right from here. Son of Man. Son of Man comes before the Ancient of Days and receives from him glory and sovereignty. What we're seeing here is the completion of Jesus Christ's work on the earth. Right? He's been dropped off by the clouds. Ascension, we know that Jesus was taken in the clouds. Here we have him coming out of the clouds into his Father's presence. He's done the work that he's been assigned. He's accomplished the mission. He's lived a perfect life. He's died on the cross for our sins. And just as Philippians says, because he surrendered his life to death, even death on the cross, God has exalted him. That's exactly what's happening here. And it's comforting because Daniel knows there's going to be a kingdom, God's kingdom, that's never going to pass away. And it's comforting because we know that our faith, our strength, our peace of mind does not lie in the nations of this world. Because if you don't have God, if you don't have Christ, that's where your hope has to be. You got to put your hope in political parties. You got to put your hope in nations leaders. You got to put your hope in someday the nation will come around and be better somehow. Or you got to put your hope on immigrating someplace better, maybe. That's got to be your hope if you don't have God. But if you have God, if you believe in Jesus Christ, you know that he's got a kingdom that's never going to fail. And if you are a citizen of that kingdom, you're safe. You're secure. His dominion is everlasting. And he's not like a kingdom of the beasts. He's not terrifying. He's not chaotic. You don't know whether he's going to, you know, lick your face or bite your hand. You know he's the Son of Man. You know he's perfect. You know he's good. You know he's loving. That's the kind of kingdom that we have. That's the kind of kingdom that we're citizens of if we have Christ. Let's continue on in verse 15. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached the one who was standing there and asked him the true meaning of all this. And he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth, but the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I want to know the true meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also want to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up before which three of them fell, the horn that looked most imposing, more imposing than the others, and had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will rise, different from the earlier ones, and he will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and will oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole of heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. Now, there are two things I want to tackle in this section. First of all is kind of the nature of who it's talking about. The nations that we talked about before have all passed, right? The Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, they've all come and gone. Yet it seems like Daniel's vision is talking about the end of time, because he's talking about final judgment. He's talking about when everything will be handed over to the saints and the kingdom, when the kingdom of man will be the kingdom of God. Right? He will rule here. His will be completely done. And we know that time's not going to come until the end. So what is this vision talking about? Well, just as the book of Revelation uses like the imagery of Babylon, even though Babylon is way passed away, doesn't exist, but it's using kind of it as a pattern. That Rome, in its oppression of the saints, is going to look like kind of what happens at the end. That this ruler, this one little horn at the end, who's going to be boastful and blasphemous, he's going to have a kingdom that's kind of like Rome. It's going to be oppressive, it's going to be powerful, it's going to be terrifying. It's not going to actually be Rome, it's not going to be probably called Rome, but it's going to be the spiritual successor to Rome, if you will. That's why it says there's going to be 10 kings. There were never 10 kings. You look at the historical books, you look at Wikipedia, there's no 10 kings. 10 means completion. There's a completion of authority connecting this ancient Roman oppression of God's saints to what's going to come. Right, so that's that. The other big question is, well, we see here the angel, whoever Daniel talks to, gives Daniel the purpose of the vision. Verse 18, the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. So it's supposed to be a comforting dream, right? We've taken back the curtain. We've revealed everything that's going on. We know that the beasts are not so terrifying. God's in control, and God's people will indeed definitely inherit the kingdom. So why is Daniel changing colors? Why is he still so disturbed? And the key is one of the commentaries I was reading this week is if we miss why Daniel's changing color, we miss the whole purpose of the vision given to us. Right? He's not worried for himself. He's been given, you know, the assurance. God's in control. He's in control of Babylon. He's in control of Medo-Persia. Everything that happens, God's going to be in control. We saw in the narrative parts of Daniel, Daniel's never stressed about what he's going through. Even though he's thrown into a den of lions, he's like, yeah, whatever, you know, just kind of falls off him. He just goes about his day. What is he stressed about? If he's not stressed about himself, if his own future and present are secure, he must be worried about someone else. He's worried about the saints. Look at verse 21. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and was defeating them. In the vision he's watching, these terrifying beasts are coming and they're devouring and defeating the saints of God. And that's why he's so disturbed. That's why he's so curious about this fourth beast. Why is it so terrifying? Why does he have power to beat up and have authority over God's people? Why does it look like God's people are losing to this fourth beast? Daniel is changing color. He's stressed because of all the stuff that's kind of happened to the saints of God in the future. And bring it back to why we're in Daniel. How are we supposed to live as salt? We are supposed to live with concern for those undergoing persecution, for those being persecuted for their faith. Paul says, pray for those in prison. He says that we are a body, and if one part hurts, we all hurt. And if one part is joyful, we're all joyful. Today just so happens, I say just so happens, like it's coincidence, just so happens, because of God's sovereignty and timing, that today is also the International Day of Prayer for the persecuted church. Again, I didn't plan it that way, but God's on his throne. He planned it. As Daniel had concern, as he was feeling sick for what the saints of God were going to endure later on, you know, didn't even affect him. We must be concerned for those who are God's people and are being attacked by the beast, who are being attacked for their faith, whether it's physically or even just socially or economically. There are people, maybe even within our own community, definitely there are many people out in foreign countries that are trying to live out their faith, and they're being persecuted, they're being hunted down, they're being discriminated against because they follow Jesus. And we must have the same mind as Daniel. We must be sick to our stomach because of the things they're going through. We must be cut to the heart and cry out to God on their behalf. So Voice of the Martyrs has put out a little video that we're going to watch. And then I'm going to invite Jose to lead us in prayer for the persecuted church. I know I don't have a good track record of videos working properly, so let's pray this works.
Play. 이 초등학교에서 우리는 선교사들은 모두 성냥이더라고요.
In the primary school, we were taught that all missionaries were terrorists.
나중엔 잘해가지만.
They told us that a missionary will be nice to you at first, but when they get you into their homes, then they will kill you and eat your liver.
성냥이더라고 배웠습니다. 우리 마을에는 먹을 것도 없고